Harvey Miller, who I think it's fair to say needs no introduction. Harvey Miller was a bankruptcy lawyer for many, many years. In the early years of the 1960s, he practiced with Seelig & Morris in New York City. In the 1970s, he moved to Weil Gotshal, and he practiced there for another 20 or 30 years before he finally, or maybe not finally, before a few years ago, he moved to the investment banking side of the business and joined Greenhill & Co., where he is a partner at this time, and has been for the last few years. He's been the counsel in almost all of the major bankruptcy cases of the last 15 or 20 or 25 years. He's a longtime member of the National Bankruptcy Conference and many other organizations. He's taught at the law schools at NYU, Columbia, Yale, and no doubt other places. For many of us, he is quite simply Mr. Bankruptcy. Harvey, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, David.
I thought what we would do is just start by starting at the beginning, in a sense, when you first got into bankruptcy practice. At least the recorded record of your bankruptcy practice sort of starts at Seelig & Morris. I don't think that was your first law firm, but how did you end up there?
It's an interesting story. I was with a small firm in New York City, which was basically a small business law firm that had a number of partners that did reorganization work, or what they used to call in those days restructuring. And in New York City at that time, I graduated from law school in 1959, New York City had a very large garment center. And the garment center operated on unsecured credit to a large extent. Banks really did not finance those companies. They were financed by factors or commercial finance companies.
And the factors were unsecured?
The factors would buy receivables.
Okay.
And there was always a limitation on what they would buy. But the manufacturing of garments, the materials and so forth, were all on unsecured credit at that point in time. And many of those garment center manufacturers were suppliers to retail chains, and the way retail chains did business in the United States in the 60s was small chains of any place from 35 to 150 stores, and a lot of them were in small cities or relatively small cities outside of New York. And what was happening at that point in time was it was the beginning of the shopping center regime. And people were beginning to build strip centers. Kmart, the illustrious Kmart, was just beginning to blossom.
Yeah, they were very late 1950s, weren't they?
Right, and they were just starting to really expand the chain. They were building these strip centers in suburban areas. And most of these retail store chains were downtown stores. And as the shopping centers came in, and first, you know, there were strip centers, then they became malls, and then they became enclosed malls, and people were moving out to the suburbs, the downtown stores became a real drag on the companies. And the question is, what would you do with these companies? And people began to realize that there was this rejection power in the Bankruptcy Act of that time. Now, I didn't know anything about that when I graduated from law school because I was not really interested in the particular subject matter.
Did you take a bankruptcy class?
I took a course that what used to be called Creditors' Rights. I don't know if you ever ran across David, John Hanna.
Oh, yeah.
Well, he was the professor at Columbia who taught Creditors' Rights, and he was in competition with Professor Gilmore at Yale, who wrote the book on secured interest.
Right.
Professor Hanna was, I think, in his last year or next to last year at Columbia, and I sat there for 2 weeks and said, this is not going to work.
Yeah, I'll never do this stuff.
I'll never do this stuff, but it's really boring. So I transferred out of the class, I think. And I went to work at this law firm almost immediately after I graduated, and studying for the bar at the same time. And it happened that this law firm was representing a retail store chain that was in Chapter 11. And it was the biggest Chapter 11 in the Southern District at that time. It was a company called Wise, W-I-S-E Shops.
Yeah.
Privately owned, but it had almost 1,000 stores. And it was a combination of a chain that sold hosiery, a chain that sold women's wear, and a chain that sold accessories. These were actually very small stores. They were 3,500 to 5,000 feet. And they were, a lot of them were downtown stores. And the Chapter 11 was filed really to get rid of the downtown stores through the rejection process. And I just happened to be walking down the hallway in this law firm one day, minding my own business. And a partner came out of his office and saw me and said, "Hey, you." Now, I told the story, but I was trained in the Army to ignore "Hey, you." Somebody said, "Hey, you," just kept walking. Unfortunately, the corridor was very short, and he caught me. And he sent me down to the bankruptcy court, and I won't go into why. And I went down to the bankruptcy court to do this mission I had. And in those days, they weren't bankruptcy judges. They were referees in bankruptcy. And they did not wear robes. Did not wear robes.
Oh, that's interesting. And was that an informal policy?
They were not judges.
Wow.
And the district court judges were very protective of their prerogatives. So I went down. My mission was to get an adjournment, I'll tell you, supposedly uncontested. And there was it was in the United States Courthouse. They had to tell me where it was. And the judge was a man by the name of Robert P. Stevenson. And if you go back, David, and you look at the 14th edition of Collier's, you will find that I think he was the co-author of at least four volumes, maybe more.
Oh, my gosh.
Many of which he wrote with Professor Seligson. And I went into this courtroom, and it was very crowded. It was summertime. It was late August, I think. And it was a lot of people in the courtroom, and it was hot out, very hot out. And very warm in the courtroom. And there was a case called before mine. I was sitting in the back of the courtroom. And I've told the story a number of times about the three lawyers got up and from Sullivan and Cromwell. And they were all wearing three-piece suits. And they got up the counsel table. They represented the secured creditor in this particular case. And they were asking for their collateral back. And the judge comes out, and Stevenson at that point was a white-haired gentleman who wore puckered nylon shirts and wore sandals before anybody else I even knew wore sandals and lived in Greenwich Village. And he was really a curmudgeon. And he had, I believe he had some antipathy towards Wall Street lawyers for some reason. And he started questioning this lawyer who got up in his three-piece suit about, "Are you admitted to this court?" Or I think he said, "Are you admitted?" And of course the attorney said, "Of course I am." And he said, "I don't think you'll catch my drift. Are you admitted to this court?" And the guy got all flustered, and you can see the perspiration starting to bounce off him. And he said, "Well, I'm admitted to the courts." He said, "Are you admitted to the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York?" And he wasn't.
Wow.
And Referee Stevenson admonished him and marked off his motion and told him, don't you come back here until you get admitted." And in those days, I think there was a one-year, you could not get admitted in the district court until you had been admitted to state practice for at least a year. And there I was sitting in the back of that courtroom. I had not been admitted.
Oh, no.
And while I wasn't wearing a three-piece suit, but I started to perspire. and finally, when it came my term, I decided disclosure is the better course of action than anything else. So the first thing I said to Referee Stevenson is that I was not admitted to the court. I had been sent down here to obtain an adjournment of this particular matter, and that there were no objections, and the partner would send me thought that that would be sufficient. And just by making that disclosure, Stevenson was very nice to me. He would treat me like, you know, young man, I'm glad you told me. And I want you to go back and tell that partner that he should never do that again. And if he comes down here, I personally will tell him that. And I thought, this is a great court, giving me instructions to admonish a partner. So, but while I was sitting there, and it was a long calendar, I liked what was going on. There was a lot of action and a lot of give and take, and the judge was involved, and things were being disposed of, and people were making arguments. And I was there for about 3 hours. So I went back, and I said, no, that's a very interesting court. And it just happened that one of the senior associates who was working on this retail case, and it had just come up for confirmation, had made a demand for admission to the partnership or something, and the partner decided no, and he left. And they said, would you like to work on this case? And it was just the post-confirmation process. And I said, sure, why not? And it involved the whole resolution of claims. There were hundreds of claims that were challenged and objected to, and many of them were landlord's claims. So all of a sudden, once I got admitted, which has happened very shortly thereafter, I was dealing with the whole claim allowance process and getting post-confirmation relief, and there was tons of motions and applications and orders that had to be entered. And I ended up trying damage claims to landlords, against landlords, which got me involved in the bankruptcy process, and I began to study what was then the Bankruptcy Act. And the case was before, the case that I was involved in was before Asa Herzog.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, I didn't know Judge Herzog from a hole in the wall, but he was a terrific judge. And he was always very considerate to young persons. And because there was no central clerk's office, each referee had his own clerk, I found myself spending a lot of time in Herzog's, not his chambers, his office. And he would go in and out of his chambers, and he would see me. And periodically he would stop, and we would have a conversation. And Herzog, as you know, was very interested in improving the bankruptcy law. And he had been one of the authors of the what was then the most used form book with a guy named Abe Menon. And we used to talk about the court and why referees didn't get a chance to wear robes and the status of the court, which was strictly support personnel for the district court.
Right.
And over the course of that year, I got to know everybody in the bankruptcy court and a lot of the practitioners. And then the firm I was with ended up representing a creditors committee in another retail store case. Retail stores were, these chains were going very rapidly.
And we're not to sidetrack you, but were the retail stores mostly privately owned? And the reason I ask this is, at least for those of us who love bankruptcy history, one of the big issues before the 78 code was whether the cases would end up in Chapter X, which was really designed for the big cases, or Chapter XI, which was much more flexible and originally designed for small cases. And through the 1960s, increasingly big cases ended up in Chapter XI, cases of the sort you're talking about. Was it because they were, or at least in part because they were privately held, or were some of them publicly held as well?
At this point, they were privately held. And remember, this is the very early 60s. This is 60, 61.
So they really belonged in Chapter XI.
Yes. They were most of them were all unsecured debt. There was very little secured debt. And they were real candidates for Chapter XI, except that the plans that were beginning to evolve affected stockholders, which you weren't supposed to do.
Okay.
And the cases were getting more complex, but they were appropriate candidates for Chapter 11, the Act Chapter 11.
Right.
And this case came along, which was a retail store chain, and the attorney for the debtor was Professor Seelison, who was then the senior partner at Seelison & Morris. Actually, it was Seelison & Morris in Newburgh. And his second, if you want to call it that, was Leonard Rosen. And the firm I was with represented the creditors committee. And I guess I was sort of a gadfly driving Leonard Rosen crazy in the case about we needed more disclosure, more reporting, and we actually negotiated that Chapter 11 case to a plan of arrangement, as it was known under XI. And in the process, I got to know Professor Seelison fairly well. The case was confirmed, and like the next month, the firm I was with filed a case for a sweater manufacturer by the name of Hans Altman, which made cashmere sweaters, as I remember. And this was an unusual case because it involved secured creditors, and it was an 11. And Walter Heller had a lien on a lot of the assets, and there was a plant in upstate New York as well as one in Europe. And the plant in upstate New York had another mortgage on it, and the case got very complex. And there was another attorney involved by the name of Sidney Krause, who at that time was one of the preeminent bankruptcy lawyers. And I ended up with, I think, 2 years of experience or something like that, really doing the work for the debtor. And we got down to a situation in which there was a fight among the lien holders as to who owned the plant. And we had a trial before the bankruptcy judge, who was a judge by the name of Herbert Lowenthal. And it was, I think, you know, compared to my landlord trials, it was a whole array of attorneys. And it went on for a couple of weeks. And I don't know if you ever heard of Harry Margolis?
Yeah.
He was representing another secured creditor. And Harry was stuck out in that time. He was more like the litigators today. Anything went. He'd say stuff, I mean, he never got sort of sidetracked by the facts, which you see a lot of today. And these hearings would go on into like 6, 7 o'clock at night. And one day, as the hearing was over and we were packing up, Harry said something about, you know, why are you wasting your time where you are? You ought to come to work for me. We'd be a great combination. You know, he was at Hahn Hessen. And I was kidding around with Harry and said, what do you got to offer? He said, come and see me. So I said, sure, Harry. Leonard Rosen was standing there and said, talk to me when you get out. And so I said, what's up, Len? And he said, before you go to see Harry, come to see me. And their offices were in the same building at that time. They were in the Empire State Building. So I said, sure. And I wasn't really going to do anything. And then I said, well, I might as well find out what Harry wants. So I made an appointment to see him. And Leonard said, before you go up there, come to see me. So I went to see Leonard Rosen. And he said, Leonard was really interesting because he said to me, I really wanted to warn you. I don't think that it would be a good thing for you to go to work with Harry. But since I thought about that, I've gone a step further. And if you're interested in leaving, why don't you come to Seelison & Morris in Newburgh? And I said, well, are you making me an offer? He said, no, I'm just asking whether you wanted to. Only the professor could make an offer. So I said, but then he said, whatever Harry offers you will match. So I went to see Harry, and from a material standpoint, in terms of basic compensation, it was a material increase. Now, I must tell you, I wasn't really thinking about leaving where I was. I was pretty happy where I was. And so then I called Leonard up, and he said, we'll match it. but you have to see the professor. And he was, I think he was on vacation at the time. And he's coming back next week, so I went to see him the next week. And we had a good relationship. He said, he had once told me before when they were enlarging the firm that if I was older, they would have made me an offer, but I was too young. So I said, am I old enough now? He said, yes, we'll take you in, but on a temporary basis. And I said, well, what does that mean? And he said, well, we have a spot for you because we've been engaged by the Chapter 10 trustees of a company called the Sire Plan, which is a real estate Chapter 10. The only problem is there's a motion to dismiss the Chapter 10. And if the Chapter 10 cases, and there were a lot of them, I forget, there may be 35 of them, if the Chapter 10 cases are dismissed, then we probably won't have enough work for you. So it has to be a temporary job. And I remember going home and speaking with my wife and describing that to her, and she said, well, you're never going to leave where you are because you're happy, and take a temporary job. And I woke up in the morning and I said, I'm going to surprise you because I'm going to take it. And I called them up and said, yes. And then the professor said to me, that's great. Now all you have to do is get permission from the firm you're with that you can leave. And I was stunned. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I can't hire you if they're going to object. And I said, Professor, I don't get it. If I tell them I am leaving and they say they refuse to consent, I have no future there either. So he said, well, that's the way it is. And that's interesting. That's the way the legal profession was in those days.
It's really hard to imagine that now.
It's so different. It's just amazing. So anyway, I told the senior partner I was leaving. He objected. And I'll tell you why he objected in a minute, but I said to him, Fred, I'm really leaving. He said, no, you're not. He was going away on vacation. He said, I expect to see you here when I get back. And I said, when are you coming back? He said, in 10 days. I said, okay, I'll tell you what. I'm giving you 3 weeks notice. He said, yeah, I understand, but you'll be here. And what he was referring to, I was playing a big role in what was basically the first public company, major public company that had filed under Chapter 11. It was a company by the name of Grayson Robinson Stores.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a public company. It was Grayson Robinson Stores, and there was another chain that was attached to it. And it was had a large public profile because the owner, the major stockholder, was a man named Maxwell Gluck, I think his name was.
Oh, yeah.
Who had been nominated by President Eisenhower to be the ambassador to Ceylon, now Sri Lanka. And when he was before the Senate committee and they asked him the name of the president of Ceylon or Sri Lanka, he didn't know it.
Oh, no.
And it was blasted across all the newspapers. In any event, Grayson Robinson had expanded. I don't remember exactly how many stores there were, but there were a lot. And the market had collapsed in 61, I think. Was it 61 or 62? 61, I think it was. And they got into a liquidity crisis, and they were going to do a $10 million public bond offering. And as it was coming to the market collapsed. So they weren't able to sell the bonds. And that precipitated the filing under Chapter 11. And Grayson Robinson was represented by Paul Weiss Rifkin. Lloyd Garrison was the lead attorney. Think about that.
Wow, that's amazing.
And they filed a Chapter 11. Herzog got the case. And immediately, the SEC got all rambunctious. And the attorney in the New York office, a man by the name of Richard Bandler, immediately got in touch with Paul Weiss and said, you filed under the wrong chapter. And Garrison and the Paul Weiss team said, no, you don't really need a Chapter 10. This is a simple case of restructuring unsecured debt, and it was a substantial amount of debt. And Bandler said, no, public companies belong in Chapter 10. And then my firm got appointed as the attorneys for the creditors committee in a most amazing organizational meeting that I won't go into right now. And Lloyd Garrison said, well, you have to, the committee, you have to support us on staying in Chapter 11. And we got involved in negotiations with the commission, actually went down to Washington. And I have to say, Lloyd Garrison and Judge Rifkin had a lot of connections politically.
Oh, I guess so.
And we got a hearing before the full commission as to whether this company should be, the Chapter 11 case should be transferred to Chapter 10. And what the company did, and I always thought it was very interesting, they had filed in the fall, and the company made this plea to the full commission that to transfer the case to Chapter 10 before Christmas would be disastrous and would doom the reorganization effort and result in the liquidation. And no matter what decision was made by the commission, it certainly should be deferred until after Christmas.
And the idea was that bringing in a trustee would take so long,
and it would upset the Christmas sales, et cetera, et cetera. And the commission came out and said they would defer any decision until after Christmas. Richard Bandler was furious. He was an interesting guy, Richard. And Christmas came and went, and then the SEC came back and said, well, now it's time. And they had a new argument. In those days, Easter was a big sales season for retail stores.
Right.
So they renewed the arguments to the SEC on the grounds of you can't make the company lose the Easter season. And once again, they prevailed. The commission said, we will wait till after Easter. But this time, after Easter, we will move, I think it was Section 325 of the old Act.
Right, I think that's right.
To transfer the case to Chapter 10. And the Easter season came, which was, you know, in those days, it was a big millinery season. Easter sales weren't that good in any event. And they made the motion. And I'm trying to remember the judge who heard it. David, I can't remember his last name. It was heard in the district court. And I wrote the briefs for the creditors committee. And then I was supposed to argue on the creditors committee, and that's when I left.
And y'all wanted it in 10, or you wanted it to stay in 11?
We wanted to stay in 11.
Yeah.
And the district court denied the SEC motion. I'm trying to remember the best I can, David. It went up to the Second Circuit. It was heard in the Second Circuit, I believe, Henry Friendly.
Yeah, I think this is ringing a bell.
Wrote the decision. And one of the key points, I don't remember the exact language, was he gave considerable weight to the desires of the creditors in terms of the needs to be served,
right,
the
parts right.
to be served. And the unanimous support of the creditors was very important to him. And I wrote the brief for the Court of Appeals. I made a mistake. I left it just before the argument in the Court of Appeals. That was the end of that. Grayson Robinson stayed in 11. It was not a successful reorganization, as I recall. I think it came out, but it was totally different. Much of it was liquidated. And that, the point I'm trying to make to you, is that was the first public company
right.
of significance that I remember using 11. And that opened up the door to thinking about publicly owned companies going into 11. And, you know, the concept of an arrangement under Chapter XI was you can only affect unsecured debt. You couldn't deal with secured debt. You could not affect equity. Well, as you begin to think about it, when I started working for Professor Thielerson and I started thinking about it, I said, yeah, but, you know, if you can hold the secured creditors off,
it has the same effect.
it's not affecting them. And the Supreme Court in Continental Illinois Bank had determined that suspension of remedial rights is constitutional. That's one thing. And if you had enough authorized stock, you really weren't using the plan process to affect equity security holders, but you were diluting them. And the court said that was, those were all right. So as we got deeper into the 60s, what was happening in the 60s, we were having a period called going public. It wasn't IPOs. They didn't call them IPOs in those days. It was just a question of going public. Wall Street was changing. There really weren't many, there weren't investment bankers in the sense that we think of them today. Wall Street was dominated by broker-dealers. And within the broker-dealer organizations, like Merrill and J.P. Bache & Co., were a new breed coming out of the business schools about developing public markets. And I remember sitting at a meeting in 63 or 64, and this man had come up from Wall Street and said, we are very interested in taking underwriting public offerings. And all we need are companies that have $1 million in volume. We're not so concerned about net profits. It's the volume that counts. The PIMSO line is $1 million in revenues. Well, in this garment center, which was thriving at that time, if a garment manufacturer had what they called a hot number, it would sell out during the season, and they'd easily make $1 million in volume. Of course, the next season they may not have that hot number, but they, a whole slew of garment center companies went public. There was a firm in the city of New York then, Marshall Bratter, Allison Green and somebody. They basically, 90% of their practice was taking companies public. And these companies started going public, and the next season, as I said, the product wasn't so good. So they would begin to have liquidity crises. And those companies started going into Chapter 11. And as each of those companies went into Chapter 11, we got into this debate with the SEC. The commission took the position initially, it was a public corporation, and had to be in Chapter 10. And the decisions that started coming out was saying, no, the sine qua non is not that it's a public company, but rather what are the needs to be served by the company that's in the bankruptcy process. And I think it was, no, it wasn't American Trailer Rentals. There were a couple of cases, certainly in the Second Circuit, where it was needs to be served.
Right.
And the Second Circuit was pretty balanced. There was another case, as I recall, Canandaigua Racetrack or something, in which Henry Friendly also wrote the decision, which Sidney Krause had filed. In that case, because of public bonds that were outstanding, I think, the Second Circuit ruled in favor of the SEC. So what developed was a demarcation. if there were public bonds, the commission said, no, you've got to be in Chapter 10. They no longer made the argument that simply because it was a public corporation, because that had been squelched. And it may have been, I don't recall off the top of my head, a Supreme Court decision that said something to that effect.
Right. There's a case called Schlensky from 1956.
General Stores or something like that?
Right, right.
So the commission very quickly adapted to the issue of, hey, listen, if you have public debt, the only way the public bondholders can be protected is with all of the protective provisions of Chapter 10. And that was a debate. And we had all these 325 motions going back and forth. But as the 60s progressed and we got to the 70s, the cases began to get bigger. I would tell you, David, that in the early and mid-60s, you rarely, rarely saw a bank in these cases. Banks were not involved in these cases because they did not extend credit to these companies. These companies were not considered bank creditworthy. And then at the end of the 60s, suddenly banks began advancing money to these companies. and suddenly you would see Chemical Bank or First National City Bank actually advancing money, and in most cases on an unsecured basis. Remember, this was largely before the UCC came into being. And you, I don't know, but you're too young to remember, David, all of the distinctions in bills and notes.
Right, right. I've never figured those out because I came out just after the UCC had kind of occupied the field.
It was so easy to misfile, and if you misfiled, you didn't have a valid lien. So it was very complicated, and the banks found it easy to do unsecured credit. And as we got to the 70s, the UCC was then beginning to catch on. Banks were expanding. And how does banking business expand? You know, you extend credit, more and more credit. And the early 70s saw public companies, mostly a lot of them in the retail store chains, who there was a depression in the 73, 74 area. Again, the changing economic conditions of retailing, where these chains started failing again. And at the same time, in the real estate industry, I once said this to somebody else, or a lot of other people, in the early 70s, there was a theory in the United States that as time progressed, no American would be working more than 4 days a week. And that raised the issue, what are our Americans going to do with their leisure time? And I guess people, great brains, thought about it, and they said, well, Americans are going to travel, or they're going to have second homes. And what evolved was the introduction of a thing called the Winnebago, which was a recreational vehicle.
Now, I do remember them.
And they got about a mile and a half to the gallon. Well, if you're going to have Winnebago's recreational vehicles, you need recreational vehicle parks. And you also need campgrounds. And then you, for even the more affluent, you need second home developments. So there was a burst of enthusiasm for expansion of the real estate empires in the world. And at just about that time, the adoption of the real estate investment trust laws, which provided that if you had a real estate investment trust and you distributed 95% of your earnings to stockholders, you had no tax. And that spurred the creation of real estate investment trusts in the late 68, 69, early 70s. And many of the real estate investment trusts were sponsored by banks. So you had Continental Mortgage Investors, Chase Manhattan Mortgage and Realty Trust, and various banks were sponsoring these REITs. They actually did not own them, but they acted as a sponsor and agent for the REIT, and the REIT provided a borrower for the bank. So, particularly the construction and development REITs, and the bank would lend money to the REIT, which the REIT would then lend out to its customers and take back mortgages and other security. Well, this was such a good business that the banks hit their lending limits on lending to these REITs. And as the agent or sponsor for these REITs, they suggested, well, maybe the thing to do is the REITs ought to go out and sell bonds to the public. Subordinated bonds, that is. So the banks would be in the senior position, and then the public could buy subordinated bonds. And it caught on like wildfire. And these REITs really sold substantial amounts of bonds to the public. And then along came the oil crisis, the embargo.
Right.
With Iran. And I don't know if you remember this, David, but I can remember on 10th Avenue in Manhattan, a line of cars going back 8, 9, 10 blocks waiting to get into a gasoline station to get 5 gallons of gas, and rules being put into effect that you can only get gas if the last number on your license plate was odd on odd days, and you're going to get on even days and so on.
Yes, I do remember that.
It was a real crisis at the time, very different from today. So what happens to Winnebagos in that time? Nobody wants to drive a Winnebago. And what happens to second home developments and RV parks and campgrounds? Tenants falls off, people default on their contracts to buy second homes, and the consequence of that was the REITs, starting in 73, I think, started to get into liquidity crises. And at the same time, because of the embargo and inflation that started to take place, the retail chain started going. So from my perspective, and where I was and what I was doing, was a great opportunity for me because I saw all this. And I just fortuitously had been invited to be a lecturer in PLI programs. And in a couple of PLI programs, I was pointing out what a distressed business could do. And in the audience were a number of CFOs. And I remember after that one particular one, I got calls from three CFOs and very quickly got three decent-sized cases. And I filed those, and they were public companies. And immediately the SEC got involved. And this time it was a recognition that on an enterprise valuation, the equity interest holders of these companies probably were not going to participate. But the commission's position was that the bondholders were entitled to the protections of Chapter 10. So we started the 325 process again. By this time, I think Dick Bandler was gone, and Marvin Jacob was the regional administrator or person in charge of this. And in the early 70s, almost to the end of the 70s, we, almost the adoption of the bankruptcy code, this fight was going on continuously about which chapter. And I would say that I don't think I lost the case on keeping it in Chapter 11. It was a recognition by the courts that the record in Chapter 10 was dismal. And I had grown up doing two big Chapter 10 cases. Trustees were not particularly efficient. In most cases, they were attorneys. In most cases, there were three. They were patronage appointments. And we were beginning to churn out Chapter 11 reorganization cases under the arrangement chapter, in which there was really a very comprehensive reorganization, a completely new capital structure. And the companies did function afterwards. So the game changed. Banks were much more involved. And in 1975 was the first billion-dollar Chapter 11. And that billion-dollar Chapter 11 was W.T. Grant Company.
Right.
Which everybody was shocked at because it had once been one of the premier retail chains in the United States, in which we went through the same process with the SEC, and the SEC finally backed off. It was an unfortunate case. It did not last in Chapter 11 very long. In fact, it's the only Chapter 11 case that Wachtell Lipton ever filed.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting.
Len Rosen and Marty Lipton were the lead attorneys. It was filed on October, I remember this very clearly, it was filed on October 2, 1975. It had around 1,200 stores throughout the United States. It had started a new concept for itself called Grand City Stores, which were 150 to 180,000 square feet. It was the prime tenant in a building on Times Square called the W.T. Grant Building. 1505 Broadway, and people were in a state of shock. And the committee, which I ended up representing, was very concerned about the viability of Grant. And there were lots of things that we discovered after we got in there. The company really had not been very competently managed and had been suffering from an inability to get goods because of their credit standing. So the stores had empty shelves. So a decision was made, and this is sort of funny also, a decision was made that the existing management could not properly administer 1,100 to 1,200 stores. So before Thanksgiving, the decision was made to liquidate all the stores west of the Mississippi, which was over 500 stores, and also some of the newer stores. And the question was, how do you do that? Nobody's ever done something like that. And it was a question, you know, the committee got concerned, could they self-liquidate? And the conclusion, which I didn't agree with, is that they can't do it on their own. So we'll have to get a liquidator. And in those days, there weren't that many liquidators. Most of the liquidators were in hard goods, machine goods. But there was one liquidator from California who was fairly well known in the machine world. And a man that worked for him was just starting his own liquidation firm. And his name was Sam Nassy. And what the committee did is they hired Booz Allen to do a valuation of what might be realized. And as I recall it, Booz Allen came back and said if you could get 18 cents on the retail dollar, it would be extraordinary. And there was a lot of inventory. Not the best inventory, but a lot of inventory in the stores. And using that as a guideline, the committee and Grant began to interview the liquidators, and this Sam Nassy came in and made a proposal. And we thought on the committee, you know, we wanted to make sure we were going to get a good return, so we were trying to negotiate for a guarantee from the liquidator. And they were, you know, they were rejecting this because they had never done a liquidation this big. And giving a guarantee means you're really putting your own money up.
Right.
So we negotiated with Nassy and went back and forth, and he said, this is from recollection, I may be off a penny or two. He would finally, he would guarantee, I think it was either 23 cents or 26 cents, which we thought was like a major victory. But over that amount belonged to him. There was a lot of discussion about that. We said, well, we think we can continue to negotiate with him. And we did. So I think, as I recall, whatever the Plimsoll line was, he got the next 5 or 7 or 8 cents. And then after that, it was split again. And he started liquidation, and it was the 500-odd stores west of the Mississippi were liquidated in about, I think it was either 14 or 18 days.
Wow.
And he did it with 7 people and all the Grant employees. And he got about, as I recall, and I can be off again, 43 or 46 cents on the retail dollar. So he made a lot of money. And it was a successful liquidation. And he came back afterwards, and he met with the committee and Grant, and he said he thought it was so successful that he thought there ought to be another $6 million or something like that provided for his 7 people. And we said, hey, we made a deal. You made out very well on this deal. I forgot how many millions he got. He said, no, but my people did a good job. And I remember saying to him, Sam, they were okay, but you used Grant people, basically. You didn't go out of pocket. We paid all those salaries and everything. So he said he thought we were being very parsimonious. So he had his attorneys make a motion in the bankruptcy court. And the bankruptcy judge was John J. Galgate, who was a terrific guy, terrific judge. And Sam was a real Californian. He was a big man, 6 foot, and I would say 260 pounds or something. and he comes to court, and again, some things you never forget in your life, wearing a powder blue leisure suit.
Those were the days.
And a shirt which is open basically down to his belly button, wearing a gold medallion. And the matter gets called, and his attorney gets up and makes his pitch, and he puts Sam on the stand to testify what his people did. And he testifies, and Gage looks at him. He says, "Mr. Nasty, let me tell you something. For approximately 18 days of work, you made X millions of dollars, right?" And he says, "Yeah." And he said, "And you paid the seven people, or six or seven people you employed, X million dollars, right?" He was right. "And now you want to give those people basically $1 million each in addition." And he said, "Right." And Gage looked at him and said, "I have a suggestion for you. Take it out of your own money." Motion denied. So he didn't get that. But that started the whole process of liquidators.
Now, was this all taking place in Chapter XI?
Yes.
In Grant?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And what happened to Grant after that, then it got focused on what about the 500-plus stores in, east of the Mississippi. And in the last week of December, a determination was made by the committee that Grant was not viable and it should be converted to ordinary bankruptcy and a trustee appointed. And the committee made a motion to do that. And we persuaded Len Rosen and the company that that was the best alternative. There wasn't any management at the company, really. And they had huge credit receivables that were uncollectible in large measure. And who opposed it? The SEC.
Oh, that's great.
So we had a trial, I think it was a day or 2 days, before Judge Gage on the conversion. The SEC opposed it. They cross-examined our witnesses, and Judge Gage granted the motion to convert. And the case was converted at the end of January of 76. And a trustee was elected. A guy by the name of Charles Rodman, who had been the CEO of Grand Union Supermarkets. And at that time, interestingly, David, the bank creditors had claims of about $640 million. Now, $640 million in 1975,
yeah, that's a lot of money,
would be equal to what? I mean, and there were 35 banks, as I recall. Originally, there had been a syndicate of 108 or 128 banks, and the larger banks bought out the smaller banks, and it had come reduced to 35 banks. And the creditors committee was six banks and five trade creditors, and that was very interesting. But after the conversion, Charlie Rodman took over as trustee, and the liquidation of the assets wasn't easy, and there was the banks claimed to be secured, so they tried very quickly to get an order directing the trustee to turn over the collateral to them, and there was a big fight over that. I drafted a answer to their motion with Marsha Goldstein that sort of became, it was reproduced in a lot of PLI books. A lot of defenses were interposed. And there was also a fight with the unsecured creditors. Before the Chapter 11, the banks had agreed to share their liens to a certain extent with unsecured creditors who extended credit to W.T. Grant, and then they tried to renege on that. So there was a lot of litigation, and then there were two classes of bonds, and the subordinated bonds, some people bought them and thought they could bring equitable subordination claims, so that delayed the case. But ultimately, and it took, let's see, 76, it took about 5 years to administer the whole estate, maybe six. The banks ended up getting just about $600 million back, and many of the unsecured creditors got paid in full. One bond issue got paid in full, and the subordinated bondholders, ultimately, we made a settlement with, and they got, my recollection is like 19 cents. So I thought it was a very successful case. And it was a landmark case. I mean, there were a lot of appeals in that case. I was up in the Second Circuit all the time. And one of the seminal cases on compromises and settlements, which is it's W.C. Grant, but Rodman's name is in the title, is what do you have to prove, or what's the standard for approving a compromise and settlement, which talks about the zone of reasonableness, and it only has to be at the lowest rung of reasonableness to be approved in the exercise of judgment. And then, of course, there's another, well, that's another decision I'm not going to talk about. That was a landmark case, and that was followed in the second half of the 70s by...
We pause this week's podcast to bring you bankruptcy in the news. Tower Records filed for Chapter 11 protection for the second time in 2 years on Monday. As brick-and-mortar music retailers continue to experience distress, Tower cited intense competition from legal and illegal music downloads, as well as from big-box retailers, such as Best Buy and Walmart, in its bankruptcy filing. There were roughly 9,500 chain music stores in the U.S. in 1991, compared with about 2,000 now, according to Billboard magazine. Tower Records is the largest freestanding brick-and-mortar music retailer with 89 stores across the country. The struggling company first filed for bankruptcy in 2004. Tower said that it will attempt to finalize a sale of the chain within 60 days, subject to court approval. Music industry analysts said the Transworld Entertainment Corporation, a mall-based music retail chain, would be the most likely buyer. Transworld Entertainment currently operates such mall-based music retail store brands as FYE and Sam Goody. Tower also announced that it received $85 million in debtor-in-possession financing from its primary lender, CIT Group. This has been John Hartgen of the ABI. Thank you for listening, and now back to this week's podcast.
Question I keep thinking as you get into the 70s about the 1978 code and how many of us have always thought of that as transforming business bankruptcy. Do you feel as though we would have ended up somewhere more or less like where we are now even without the 1978 code? It sounds like a lot of the things that we associate with the 78 code, negotiated deals and restructuring rather than a process overseen by the SEC, was starting to occur in the late 60s and early 70s. Would we have ended up in the same place, or was the code necessary to where we ended up?
I don't think we would have ended. We would have been there for a period of time, but the pendulum would have swung back someplace in there. I believe that everything that occurred from the early 70s, and not from the from the early 70s and the late 60s, were things that helped the condition what ultimately became the bankruptcy code. As you may remember, the first bankruptcy commission was appointed in 70, and it was given a two-year term.
Right.
And because they didn't get funded, and actually, as I recall, did not start until 71. They got an extension date, and they actually came out with the report in 73, to which was attached the Bankruptcy Act of 1973. It was a very clever thing that that commission did, because under Nixon, whenever there was a problem, they appointed a commission.
Right.
And generally, the commission would file a report. They'd get to meet with the president. He would give them cufflinks or something. Golf balls, and then the report would be put in the dustbin. What this commission did Harold, what was his name from California? Harold
Marsh. No, not Marsh.
Marsh.
It was Marsh.
Who wrote the California Corporation Law.
Right, okay.
Was very politically attuned, and he said, we have to do a proposed statute. That's how you move Congress. And they did. And that, while it wasn't adopted, it formed the foundation for people to talk about.
Right.
Bankruptcy reform. And actually, you know, in that Bankruptcy Act of 1973, there was no exclusivity. And in fact, there was a trustee in every case. And I can remember arguments about that. Oh, that's a terrible thing for mom and pop stores and things like that.
Do you remember when that got switched in the legislative process, when the trustee concept was abandoned and we got more or less the, what turned out to be Chapter 11?
Was in the first iteration, I don't remember if it was H.R. 1 or H.R. 2, there were two bills that were introduced. One, Congressman Edwards was supporting, and they took out the trustee concept and they put in the a limited exclusivity. And that, I think that was like maybe 2 years after the 73.
Right, right. I think that's right.
And then what had concerned everybody, particularly the bankruptcy judges, were very concerned because under the 73 proposal, and maybe the one that was working its way through Congress, I think it provided that the president would appoint the bankruptcy judges. And they realized that they were all in jeopardy and they would be out of work. Even if the president appointed them, it had to go through the confirmation process in the Senate.
Right.
And they were petrified of that. And they immediately organized and they proposed a bill. They may have been H.R. 2, I can't remember the numbers, in which the existing bankruptcy judges would continue. And they had other provisions. And it was those two proposed pieces of legislation that formed the framework for the debate. And then the Article 3 thing got into it.
Right.
And that raised a holy war in Congress. I can remember a congressman from California saying, I'll be damned if I'll ever vote for another 10-year federal employee when I have to run for election every 2 years. And there was a real debate in the Congress on that, which killed that legislation at that point, and then Watergate occurred, and the whole thing took a back seat to that, and really did not get revived until late 77, as I recall. I may be off in
the... Right, and then it blew up again on the Article 3 thing.
And but the debate was ongoing all through those years, and I always thought it was necessary to get the statute changed, because we were really pushing the limits on XI. And we were fortunate, at least I was fortunate, and I was doing creditor and debtor work, in that we had a very experienced and knowledgeable bankruptcy bench that understood the underlying philosophy of the need to help companies that had credit problems, that had failure problems, in an era in which credit was expanding, it was readily available, and people and entities were encouraged to borrow. When you have all this pressure on borrowing and all this need for expansion and capital improvements, you have to borrow. Well, you know there's going to be a certain percentage of failure. And you need an escape valve. And the judges of that period, at least the ones I appeared for, and it's not limited to New York. I did a number of cases in Florida, Georgia. The judges recognized that these companies were more valuable if they could be rehabilitated than if they were liquidated. And that was an important factor. And the last thing I'll tell you in this call is it was during this period that the revolving credit agreement came into being. In the early 70s, banks financed companies by giving them confirmed lines of credit, unconfirmed lines of credit, and it was very individual. Chase did not tell Chemical that it was lending to the same borrower. And in some cases, debtors used to play off the banks against one another. If one bank was secured, they'd try to get that bank to work against the unsecured, to get the unsecured bank, say you can't let the secured bank take the collateral. Well, what happened in the REIT cases was when you called a meeting of creditors in the REIT cases, all these banks would show up. And in one of the major cases, it may have been Continental Mortgage Investors, when they called the meeting, all these banks were in the room, and the bank officers looked at one another and said, "Are you in this credit?" Yes. And they said, "Oh, my goodness." And there was a young associate whose name I can't remember, who I can see in my mind's eye right now, who said, "You know, this is wrong. This is going to be very hard to administer these cases, and there are going to be more of these cases unless we have some structure." And he proposed the way to deal with this, where we have a syndicate of 20 banks or whatever it was, is we need an agent, and we need a unitary agreement. And out of that came the revolving credit agreement. When we refinanced these REITs, the banks all lined up. They appointed somebody as the agent. It was one loan agreement, one security agreement. It was a remarkable change from the way things were before. And they then acted as a block. And it did not occur to me again how revolutionary that was until a few years ago, when in the 90s, when Donald Trump got into trouble. When Donald got into trouble, and we finally had a meeting of the creditors, he had never had a revolving credit agreement. So there were different banks in different positions. And it was because the banks were in different positions that to this day, I believe Donald was able to stay out of bankruptcy. Because the unsecured banks were extremely active in persuading the secured banks not to take any action with respect to Donald's collateral, that he had given his collateral, his property. And it was the disunity of the banks that Donald and his representatives were able to play very well to get to an adequate restructuring. And I maintain that if there had been one loan agreement and one agent, they would have taken Donald through Chapter 11 back then. So the revolving credit agreement made an enormous change. And as we have moved forward from that time, what has happened as we have progressed is the reorganization cases have changed from largely unsecured credit cases to primarily secured creditor cases.
Can I get you to tell one quick story? That is about being asked by Arthur Lyman to work on a case that ultimately brought you in contact with Justice Goldberg.
Yes, I'll tell you that story very quickly. In 1970, there was a slowdown in the economy, but more importantly, Wall Street was changing the way it operated. Broker-dealers essentially were family-run firms. There was Francis I. DuPont, there was Goodbody & Company, there was J.P. Bache & Co., and a whole series of companies like that. And the New York Stock Exchange had a capital requirements rule. And if you violated the capital requirements rule, you were required to add additional capital. In this very active period in the 60s of going public and more people were beginning to invest in the stock market and the volume on the stock market was picking up, the firms were changing. There were many more trades, there was more need for capital, and it was the beginning of the conversion from handwritten records to computer-driven records. The back offices were beginning to get computerized, but nobody had really done computerization of a broker-dealer back office with great success. It was just starting. The way broker-dealers was run, the cashier in each firm ran what was called a cage, where all the securities and all the cash were. And some of the firms lost track of their transfers, their stock transfers. There's a thing called fail to deliver and fail to receive. And if you have a fail to deliver and it's outstanding for a certain number of days, you get a capital charge. And what was happening in the exchange in its own internal regulation, as it ordered these firms, began to levy capital charges. And the firms would then get a letter from the exchange saying that you have to replenish your capital account. And I remember cases of people going to see Mrs. DuPont, because Francis I. DuPont was in capital violation at one point, and she's saying, no, I'm not putting any more money in there. So what happened starting in 1970, actually started in 1969 with a small firm, but it continued in 1970 with larger firms, where firms were going into capital violation and they didn't have the credit for the capital to cure it. And the New York Stock Exchange had, because of the Ira Halp bankruptcy and the salad oil scandal, had created a special trust fund. And the then president of the exchange, Keith Funston, had made a declaration that no public customer would suffer financial loss because of the failure of an NYSE member. And to protect customers, at the same time as the salad oil scandal occurred, the exchange created a special trust fund. And it was funded, ultimately, with $25 million prior to 1970. And along came 1970, and the second major firm to fail was McDonald and Company, and a liquidator. And the way the exchange worked, the special trust fund became available if the company would agree that the exchange could appoint a liquidator. And the liquidator would take over and administer the assets of the broker-dealer. And McDonald, which is the case I worked on, used up $21 million of the special trust fund. And right after McDonald, there were a series of cases of broker-dealers who went into capital violation and could not raise capital. And the consequence was the exchange had to increase the special trust fund. At first they did it from the members, and then the exchange was supposed to build a new exchange at the foot of Wall Street. They used the building fund. So that over a course of 2 years, I think it was, I got appointed as special counsel for the exchange. We used the entire special trust fund, expended it was gone. And along comes another case by the name of First Devonshire Corporation, which was in capital violation, and the exchange had no money to put in. And it was a real quandary. And three subordinated creditors of First Devonshire Corporation filed an involuntary bankruptcy petition against First Devonshire Corporation. The SEC got all over the exchange about what about your pledge and so on, and we had a lot of strategy sessions, and I said the only way we can deal with this, because we need time to raise money, why don't we convert the bankruptcy case to a Chapter 11? Then we can get control of the case, we can liquidate the assets, which will give us an opportunity to raise money and pay the public customers, and then we'll see whether the exchange can raise any money. So Arthur Leibert was representing other investors in First Devonshire and the offices, and he was very anxious for the exchange to come in, so he was going to cooperate with us. And so We made a motion under 325 to convert the bankruptcy to a Chapter XI case. By this time, the chief judge of the Southern District had taken the bankruptcy case as an opportunity to appoint a receiver. And he appointed a receiver, a practitioner, and then referred the case to a bankruptcy judge who had been appointed by him. And I looked at that and said, boy, we got an uphill fight. But anyway, we made the 325 motion. And Arthur was going to argue with the case with me and Professor Felixson. And the night before, the day before the argument was scheduled, I get a call from Arthur, and he says, I can't go to the hearing. There's a very important meeting or hearing in the Bethlehem Steel case, and I have to go to that. And I said, well, I'm sorry to hear that. So he said, but I'm getting a substitute. So I said, who? So he said, Justice Goldberg will take my place. I said, oh, that's very nice. And he said, you will have to come over here and explain to Justice Goldberg what's involved and what bankruptcy is and so on. And I said, okay, no problem. He said, well, you be here at 5 o'clock, and I will introduce you to Justice Goldberg, who had just joined Paul Weiss at the time. He had resigned from, he was an ambassador to the UN at the time. And I got over there, and Arthur takes me aside, and he says, now remember, do not call him Arthur. I said, well, how do you refer to him? And he said, Justice. Some Justice. And I said, fine. And he takes me over to Justice Goldberg's office, and Justice Goldberg is very fastidious. When he came to the firm, he wanted to be on a par with Judge Rifkin. So the story they told me is that he actually measured Rifkin's office so that his office would be exactly the same.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, Rifkin had a sweet tooth, so he had a kitchen attached to his office. Justice Goldberg, who was planning to run for governor of New York, was always on a diet, always wanted to look a certain way, and he had this shock of white hair. He didn't want a kitchen, so he had a bathroom. And the day before, the hot water pipe had burst. So it had flooded his office and destroyed his carpet. So he was so apologetic by the fact that he did not have a carpet and we were sitting on the concrete floor. I said, that's no problem, Justice. So we're sitting there. He said, tell me about the case. So I started to describe the case to him, and he said, oh, bankruptcy. I know about that. And he had a bookcase with all of his Supreme Court decisions. And he goes up to the bookcase, I'll never forget this, and he pulls out the bound volume with the decision from American Trailer Rentals, which is a compromise and settlement case.
Right.
Which is a long decision. And he read it to us. And I was sitting there listening to him and saying, gee, it's a nice decision, I've used it, it's well written, but it has nothing to do with our problem. So he said, so you see, I know about bankruptcy. And then we explained the issue to him. And I explained to him that the bankruptcy judge who would hear the motion was somewhat cantankerous. He had been the Democratic Party boss in the Bronx, very close to the chief judge, and the man who had been appointed receiver was one of his best friends. And on top of that, he was essentially deaf. So you would have to speak very loudly. So he said he understood all that, and we got up, you know, after 2 or 3 hours. And he said, you think I should call the judge? And I looked at him and I said, I beg your pardon? And he said, well, shouldn't I call the judge and talk to him? I said, Justice, I don't think that's a good idea. So he said, okay. And we left. And the next day, Professor Felixson and I go down to the federal courthouse. And the crowd was so large, this hearing was in the largest courtroom in Foley Square. And we go in, and the room is packed with people who had accounts at First Devonshire, who can't get their securities, they can't get any money, really angry people. And I was afraid it was going to be a riot. And Justice Goldberg comes in, and he comes up to me, and he says, is the judge here yet? And I said, I don't know. I haven't seen him. And he says, well, I did try to call him, and I didn't get any answer. So I said, oh, okay. And with that, from the back of the courtroom, not from the robing room, but from the back of the courtroom, Judge Lowenthal starts coming in, walking through this crowd. And by this time, the judges were wearing robes, and he has his robes over his arm, and he gets into the well of the courtroom, and Goldberg says to me, introduce me. I said, okay. And I said, Judge Lowenthal, I'd like to introduce you to Justice Goldberg. And Goldberg is standing in front of Lowenthal, who was a big man, and he smiles, and he says, Judge Lowenthal, nice to meet you. And Judge Lowenthal says, should I genuflect or kiss your ring?
Oh, my gosh.
I thought Goldberg looked at him and said, what? He said, oh, no, nothing. So then Lowenthal gets up on the bench, and he calls the motion. And I think I argued first, and I was going through all the reasons why it should be transferred. And it was clear that Lowenthal was not impressed or did not want to be impressed. And finally, he said to me, sit down. And I said, I'm not finished. And he said, sit down. And I said, well, Your Honor, I'm not finished. He said, if you don't sit down, I will call the marshals. So I sat down. And then Goldberg got up, and he argued. He did a good job. And the receiver's attorneys got up and argued. And they got a very warm reception. And then I got up to do some rebuttal. And he said, I thought I told you to sit down. And I said, this is rebuttal, Judge. He said, I don't want to hear your rebuttal. So Professor Felixson made a rebuttal argument. And he was just sitting up there, and he asked a couple of questions. And he said, I've heard everything. And I could see he wasn't going to do anything. So I got up, and I said, Your Honor, it's apparent to me you're going to deny the motion. So I have here a order. I'd appreciate it if you would sign the order. And he looked at me and he said, you're trying to trick me. I know you're trying to trick me. I said, no, Your Honor, it's clear that you are not impressed with the motion and you're going to deny it, and we'd like to have an order so we can go on appeal. He said, you're not going to make me sign anything. With that, he jumps up and he runs out of the courtroom. Now, we had a doctrine in the Southern District that you can appeal from a silent order, or in effect an oral order. So we had contemplated something like this was going to happen, and we had three sets of appeal papers, one from an oral order, one from a signed order, and I forget the other one. In any event, Lowenthal left, and I said to the receiver, we're going up to the district court now to get a stay of execution of the continuation of your position as receiver. And he said, well, I won't go with you. I said, it's fine, you don't have to. And I dropped the papers at his feet. And I said, Justice Goldberg, you're coming with me. He said, yes. And we went and got in the elevator to go up to a higher floor in the courtroom. And I turn around, of course, the receiver's right behind me. And we get up to the district court judge, a special part judge, who happened to be charging a jury at the moment. And he said, I'll see you after I finish the charge. And he saw us, and he listened very carefully, heard everybody, and said, I am staying the order, and we will reconvene tomorrow, and I will decide this immediately. So this had taken from 10 o'clock in the morning. It was now around 3:30 in the afternoon, and there hadn't been any lunch break. So we get out, and Justice Goldberg said, you know, I'm used to having lunch at a certain time, and I really miss it. Well, that happens in the bankruptcy court with some frequency. And what happened is we go down the elevator, and we're walking out of the United States Courthouse. And the United States Courthouse in Foley Square has a large set of steps in front of it that go down to the square. And sitting in front of the courthouse is a black limousine And Goldberg turns to me and says, "That's my car." And he puts his arm around me, and he said, "Young man, don't feel badly about the way the judge treated you. I've always said that the best place in the world for a lawyer to practice and be heard is in the United States Supreme Court, where you are treated as a true gentleman. And from the Supreme Court down, it starts to taper off. And I have to tell you, you're in the pits, and I'm not coming back."
That's great.
And then he lost the primary. So that was the end of Justice Goldberg and bankruptcy. He never came back. Never.
Well, it's a good thing you didn't take a similar tack in your career.
No, I really enjoyed what I've done.
Thank you so much. Well, I appreciate you.